Today is the 25th of September 2015. I'm interviewing Jeff Whittaker of Havelock North and now of Eskdale to talk on the life and times of his family in Hawke's Bay.
Sure, Frank. On my mother's side, the Wakemans arrived in Wellington and had to wait for the track to be cut through the 40 mile bush to take up their land holdings in Paiatua. Great grandfather was mayor of Paiatua. The family there subdivided and developed much of Paiatua. And my grandmother was born in Paiatua, where she met my grandfather. Now, my grandfather was, his father was a George Jeffrey, who arrived in Dunedin 1862. He tried to get a job in Dunedin, but he was Anglican, and as the story goes, the Presbyterians wouldn't employ him. So he then moved to the goldfields, to Roxburgh, and decided that digging gold was a fool's game, so he decided to supply the diggers with groceries and newspapers. He then joined a general merchant there, and after a few years decided that he would become a pharmacist. So George Jeffrey was the first pharmacist in the line of things. He went on to be mayor of Lawrence and did a lot of work in around Lawrence. That's where his pharmacy was. He had three sons. Two of those sons went on to be pharmacists, and some of his sons' sons were pharmacists in Roxburgh. However, my grandfather then shifted to Dannyburg, and then he shifted to Paiatua, and then subsequently started a pharmacy in Te Awamutu about 1920, from what I can gather. He obviously married my grandmother, who was Laura Wakeman, and they had three daughters, and of course my mother came from Te Awamutu. On my father's side, my great-grandfather arrived out in 1862 or roundabout. He was a farmer. He went to Clevedon in Auckland, cleared a lot of land of the trees. He cleared his own farm, and he had seven children, of which one of them was my grandmother. My grandmother had to leave school when she was in the fourth standard to look after her brothers and sisters. She, and I'm not sure how it happened, but she took up a job as a waitress or working for New Zealand Railways, and she was in Taumarunui when she met my grandfather. Now, her grandfather Whittaker came from the docks in East London. His father and his father before him were sailmakers, and Frank was 12 years old when both parents died. They didn't know what to do with Frank, so decided, since they were in a sort of a shipping business, they would send Frank to sea as a cabin boy, 12-year-old cabin boy. So Frank really had no formal education, and he sailed out of London, he sailed the world, finishing up as a ship's cook. He came to New Zealand and then worked the coastal shipping from Auckland to West Coast and Nelson. And one of the things that he remarked to me was that there was a dolphin that used to guide the ships through the channel when he was on the South Island. I always thought they referred to Tory Channel, but one day I was sailing through French Pass and I suddenly realised that that was where the dolphin had guided the ships, and the reason for that guidance was quite clear when you saw the currents.
Was this Polaris Jack?
Polaris Jack, yeah. And my grandfather used to tell me endless stories about how he led that ship and how he'd make sure that they missed the whirlpools. I never realised until I actually did it myself. He went to Wellington, he left the ship, signed off, and he was on the Penguin. And the Penguin took a new cook, sailed out of Wellington and sailed into the rocks. Can't think at the moment of the reef that they struck. And I think it was something like 260 people lost their lives, including the ship's cook. So had it not been for grandfather signing off, I wouldn't be here. He took a job at a hotel and then took a job at the Wellington Railways and opened the restaurant in the railway station there in Wellington. as the cook for the railways, they shifted him to Tamaranui to start a restaurant there. And that's where he met my grandmother. They married and then shifted to Frankton Junction, where he opened the Frankton Junction railway restaurant. One stage he was cooking 2,000 meals a day. Frank, starting as a cabin boy, finished up cooking for royalty because he was the railway's chef. And so everybody that came to New Zealand travelled by rail. And he cooked for Eisenhower, he cooked for endless dignitaries that came through, and one of the royalties that came through. So yeah, he really amassed a fair record of cooking for special people, and of course travelled from one end of New Zealand to the other on the trains. Finally, he finished up cooking for the Queen in her first visit to New Zealand. He organised the meal and supervised it at Cardrona and Hamilton. So that was the peak of his career. So my grandfather Frank and my grandmother Jane had one son, and that was my father. And he met my mother as a result of my father was pretty keen on surfing, and being a boy, he went to Tauranga and camped at the Mount and burnt himself with a lamp or a cooker. He finished up in the Waikato Hospital, and my mum was the nurse there, and they met and of course got married. My father was, as you can imagine, he was of the working class. My grandfather could do basic arithmetic, obviously could add up to 2,000 people if he had to, and knew how to order food for that number, but basically he had no education. And of course my grandmother came from farming stock, and of course then on my mother's side they were professional. My grandfather in Te Awamutu was a JP, he was a member of the council, he was respected. In fact, I met people after he died who told me that in the Depression he would supply medicine free to those who couldn't afford it. He got involved with the Tainui and Princess Te Puia, and she was ill towards the end of her life, and he did a lot with the Maori people, and Princess Te Puia recognised that involvement.
This is while he was in Te Awamutu.
Well, he died in Te Awamutu.
Well, that's the king country, isn't it?
Yes, but it was the Tainui people in Ngarawakia. I didn't know a lot of that until just recently when I was researching a piece of greenstone that was going to grandfather, and that was in recognition of his.
Just interesting listening to your story of your forebears. They certainly laid down probably some of your feeling for cooking and sailing, because you had sailmakers, sailors, a cook, and you made a comment about, you know, they were just ordinary people, but I mean 95% of people were, they were all working. The girls had to come home and look after the family, and the boys had to go and work, and you know, it was nothing easy.
No, that was life. I mean, my father had nothing when they started off, and I don't know how my memory retains it, but I can remember my grandmother saying to my mother, well, Estelle, you picked your bed and now you have to lie on it, when she was obviously pointing out they didn't have a lot of money. Dad went on to be manager, or he was called up, and he went to Norfolk Island for his training, and 2 days before they were to depart to Guadalcanal, he was playing touch rugby. He was a Waikato representative rugby player, playing touch rugby and broke an ankle, or a bone in his ankle, and was hospitalised. As I understand it, 95% of his platoon were wiped out in Guadalcanal. So I guess
that was an act of God almost.
I was pretty lucky. So he came home. He'd worked for Dalgetty's before he left. He came home and milked cows at Ruakura until Dalgetty's offered him a job selling pigs in the sale yards in Frankton Junction. I was staying with my grandmother, who had a house right next door in Wire Street, next door to the sale yards, and a tornado came through, and Dad was selling the pigs 100 metres away from where the tornado came through. My grandmother was sitting in a grocery store across the road from the sale yards, and the walls were blown out, and she was left sitting in a chair in the middle of the store. Him and my father could see us sitting there, and we lost a few sheets of iron off the roof. Yeah, so that was Dad. He went on to be manager of Dalgetty's in Whakatane, and then went on and was manager of Dalgetty's for about 24 years in Wairoa.
So you're a Wairoa person as well?
I never lived in Wairoa, I only stayed there. It was decided that if I wanted to go into pharmacy, I know my mother wanted to be a pharmacist, but, you know, they just you didn't do that.
Well, with her background, I could see why she wanted to be, because she came from a long line of pharmacists.
Pharmacists, she did. And so one day she asked me what I thought I'd like to be or do, and one of my family, I called Uncle Elmer Conlon, had fought in the First World War, been awarded the Belgian Grotegeur for his bravery. And he taught me all about carpentry and how to use tools, and I guess he was my surrogate father when Dad was away. And Mum said, well, what would you like to do? And I said, well, I really would like to be a builder. Actually, a cabinet maker would be what I'd be pretty keen on.
Well, just before you take up this, your main schooling was done.
Well, that's it. It follows on, because she said, yes, you're pretty handy with your hands. I'll tell you what, you should be a pharmacist, and then you can go and be a cabinet maker, because then you'll have the backing to be a cabinet maker. So I thought, well, that was a pretty generous sort of a thing to suggest. So not giving it any real thought in depth, I said, all right, I'll be a pharmacist. So Mum said, well, you're living in Whakatane, they don't teach Latin, so you'll have to go to Hamilton Boys High School, where your father went, and you can learn Latin. So I left home when I was 13 to live with my grandmother. So my education was Hamilton Boys High School. I had 4 years there, and then I did an apprenticeship with Jeff Warren, a pharmacist in Victoria Street in Hamilton. My first day at school, well, came across from Whakatane with some of Dad's clients. I dropped off my grandmother's with my bike, climbed on my bike as a 13-year-old, biked to the school, and grabbed Tate, the headmaster who had coached Dad at rugby and been his headmaster, said to me, was I going to play rugby? And I said, well, I'd like to, but I'd never handled rugby ball. Dad never played rugby with me, yeah. And yet was a rugby fanatic. And so, yeah, he said, well, what do I want to do? And I said, well, I want to be a pharmacist. So he said, well, you're 3A. There was 320 boys, I think, enrolled. And we're a new school, so he said, we'll see you next week across at Peachgrove School. So I rode on a bike, I think it was 5 miles from where we lived, to the school, and didn't know anybody. And that was the start of my education. So the pharmacy was a hard road. I was one of the last to go through an apprenticeship scheme. You got paid peanuts, I suppose they had monkeys anyway. And you had night school 3 nights a week. You worked Friday nights, and you had correspondence course with the School of Pharmacy in Petone or Wellington. And then you spent 3 weeks a year down in the college with practical. My pharmacist apprenticeship to Jeff Warren made everything from scratch. A very bright guy, hard to work for. He used to call me Oscar, and he had a stutter. And I must say that I didn't always come up with the answers, but by the time had his question out, I had the answer. Yeah, so he was a very hard taskmaster, and I don't think he expected that I was going to qualify, but I did pass my exams the first go, and I became a pharmacist.
How long did it take those days?
4 years.
And that allowed you to go and dispense on your own, or did you have to work under someone?
I had to work under him. And then you qualified, fully qualified as a pharmacist. And when they opened the School of Pharmacy, it was virtually the same curriculum to start off with. Mm-hmm. But you did everything practically.
So during your pharmacy training, did you play any sports?
Yes, I did. When I was at school, I realised that I wasn't fast enough for my feet, but also that I hadn't, like many boys, handled a football. Mm-hmm. I know that I played schoolboy rugby at school and on Saturdays, and I didn't have any rugby boots. We used just used to play in bare feet on the frosty ground, and I wasn't fast enough. My position was as lock in the scrum, so I virtually never got to handle the ball anyway.
Sure.
And after 2 years, I decided that was a mug's game, because all I did was run around the field after everybody else. And I decided I'd take up rowing, which was a school sport. And Dad arrived across at the end of the second year and said, "Oh, son, I bought you a pair of rugby boots." And I said, "Well, Dad, you better come down and see me row," which he never did. But so I finished up rowing in the school fours and then the eights. And that was my sport at school. Oh. So that's where, yeah, I got diverted. And I also got involved in roller skating, speed skating, dance skating. I held the Waikato speed skating title over 16 miles, I think, at one stage. So roller skating did play a big part of my life, as did rowing, because I rowed after I left school. So that sort of brings you up to, I qualified, and because I'd had such a rough time with my apprentice master, I was very happy to take a job pretty quickly away from Victoria Street. And I took a job in Te Arawa, was my first job, for a fellow called Smythe. And what I didn't appreciate was that I was manager in name only. He had an unqualified pharmacist who was his sort of partner. Smythe was sick, he didn't actually work. And all I did was really rubber stamp what Masters did. Masters was a fiery sort of a character. And I used to do my own thing because I thought, well, I'm the pharmacist, I can make creams and dispense what I want to, and I have a hand cream which I still make in the pharmacy. And I made this hand cream up in Te Arawa, and one night I came back from my tea and Masters confronted me, because we always worked Friday nights, Masters confronted me with a Bowie knife and said I was going to tell him what was in that cream. I went around one side of the table and he went around the other. When I got close to the door, I was at that door faster than grease lightning.
He was unqualified.
He was unqualified. He wanted my cream. He wasn't going to get it. And to the side there, when I went to Te Arawa, the place was infested with cats. At one stage, I counted 120 cats, which some oddball fed irregularly at the back of farms, and the smell was incredibly rancid. Anyway, one day I decided that we're going to have less cats, so I set up a whole series of baits using Secanol sleeping capsules. The next day I came to work and there was consternation with two vets trying to figure out
why the cats were all asleep.
Yeah, why these cats were drunk and going to sleep.
So you didn't go back to there?
He was okay when he was sober. And I've been there a year, and the public health pharmacist came across, nice guy, and he said to me, "Jeff, we're going to close my down," because I told them that I was manager only. In fact, I wrote to the Pharmaceutical Society and said, "How do I handle this situation? Because I know that things are irregular." And the advice from the Pharmaceutical Society was, "Oh, you just move. You just get another job." And I said, "But that doesn't overcome the situation that exists." Turned out that the secretary who was the Pharmaceutical Society ran it, he was a mate of Smythe's. We went to school together. So he wasn't going to put Smythe's pot on. Anyway, the public health pharmacist came in and he said, "Jeff, you've got 2 weeks to get out." He said, "I've got you another job in Morrinsville, because we're going to close them down, but it's not your fault. We want to have you with a clean slate." And I started work a week later in Morrinsville. In the afternoon of the day I started, public health pharmacist called in. He said, "Yeah, well, it's closed down now." And it was closed till they found a buyer for it. So then I worked in Morrinsville for a very short period of time, and the public health pharmacist came in. He said, "I think I've got your job you can apply for as a manager of the urgent pharmacy in Hastings." So I had a real old beat-up old Hillman car. Climbed into that one day and came across to Hastings and had to ask the way at Clive how I got to Hastings. Met the directors of the urgent pharmacy. They gave me the job and they put me up for the night in the Albert Hotel.
Isn't that ironic?
First place I ever stayed was the Albert Hotel.
Your son pulled it down.
My son pulled, and I went and stood in the room where I stayed just before he pulled it down. So I shifted the family to the urgent pharmacy and started work there, but I must say that that wasn't the bed of roses.
Where was the urgent pharmacy?
In Queen Street, adjacent to the bakery, Baker's Delight, is it, now it's there. It was on the north side of Queen Street, and it was right beside the Group Theatre.
So were you after or before?
Andy Duncan.
You were before Andy?
No, after him. And Andy Duncan was an absolute pillar of society, and Andy used to work every hour that God gave him for the Urgent Pharmacy. And he did a very good job. It was a very hard act to follow. One evening, it was Saturday night, I closed the pharmacy at 9 o'clock, and I went around the corner and got a takeaway, and I came back, and Graham Master, a doctor, he'd been in, and I had not been there. Next thing at 10 o'clock, I got a phone call from Graham Master saying, where the hell was I? Because he needed a prescription. He complained to the directors of the Urgent Pharmacy. I got hauled up, and they said they're going to fire me for dereliction of duty. And I said, well, surely I'm entitled to dinner. Time was to get a meal, because I was on call all night. Sure. And they told me, no, that wasn't. I was contracted to them for every hour that they were closed. So I said, well, okay, I'm sorry, but I went to get a meal. So they were thinking it over. So I went to the Labour Department. The answer was very simple. For every hour I was contracted to the Urgent Pharmacy and expected to be on call, I should be paid. And I think, from memory, it came to some £20,000 at the time, because they, all you did was took 40 hours or 44 hours out of the week, and the rest of it I was supposed to be paid for. So I came back to them and said, look, I'm sorry, but I think you owe me some money. And they decided on the spot that they would keep me on.
They didn't send someone down and look after the place while you were having a meal.
No, they agreed. It was a pretty tough call. But the funniest one was that they built on a room at the back of the Urgent Pharmacy for us. And one of the first children or young people I saw in Hastings was when Andy Duncan showed me around the house. And he opened the door and turned all the lights on, and there was Robbie Duncan and Wendy Duncan asleep in their beds. And I said, oh, you're going to wake them up? He said, no, they won't wake up. This is their bedroom. So I got introduced to Wendy and Robbie while they were asleep. Moved in, and the Group Theatre was having their first opening night, and they were running on their first play, and the play was Murder, She Cried, and they would have thunder and gunshots at 2 o'clock rehearsals in the morning. And while I could take, I was working 70 hours a week sometimes, the family were pretty distraught. So I asked them to cool the noise, and I was told that they were in an industrial area and they could do as they liked. Went to the police and they said, well, if you can't join them, then make your own noise. So I said, well, thank you very much. So I went off, and one night they were making a heck of a racket, and I went out the back and I thought, I'll have to get them to stop. And I put my hand into Andy Duncan's cactus garden, and instead of getting some pebbles, I got a rock and I hooped it at the back door. And suddenly light appears through the back door. I put the rock right through the back door. And then Patrick Dingmans comes dancing out. He comes dancing out. Yeah, well, you'll have to stop it. You'll have to stop it. I said, well, I'll give you one too. So anyway, they did stop it. And the next night was back to it again. Oh, the police came round. But by the time the police came there in the morning, I'd repaired the door. And so I got a warning. But they said, you know, if they won't come to terms, you're entitled to do whatever you like. So the first night of the play was a Saturday night. And Mrs. Mason came in, Anne Mason, and she was my assistant, and she wouldn't stay, but she sat in her car outside. So at 9 o'clock that night, I set up, well, I had set up two speakers that I got off Johnny Morris, another pharmacist. He used to play in a band, so I had his amplifier and his speakers, and I played Why Do the Nations Rage So Furiously Together, full blast at the back door. Well, some of the Group Theatre were out there on the footpath, running up and down, and police arrived, and I looked out the window, and the police were chatting there and shook their heads and continued to sit there. Then the directors of the Urgent Pharmacy arrived, and their comment was, well, Jeff, you made a point. I think you better cut it out. So I was happy to do that, because obviously the point had been made. They made me an honorary member of the Group Theatre the next day, and promised that they would never have their rehearsals to so late again. Yeah. And next evening, I'm looking out, and Michael Bostock, Dr. Michael Bostock, pulls up in his racy little car. Now, Michael's wife, Elizabeth, was a bit of an actor, and she had the lead role in the play, which was Murder, She Cried, and it was Michael Bostock coming across the road. My hair's a dust up, and there was nowhere for me to run. He came charging through the front door, through the front door open, strode through there as Michael could, strode out to the dispensary. I'm standing in one corner, he walked up to me and he said, "Congratulations, Jeff." He said, "Do you realise Elizabeth forgot 10 minutes of the play?" And laughed. And Michael and I have been friends ever since.
Oh, is that one? Were you married while you were...
I was married during my apprenticeship, which was a mistake.
And so at that stage you...
Catherine came here as a baby. Yeah, it was a real mistake. I should have done what they did in those days and walked, but I didn't. And it made life pretty difficult. So I'd been there 18 months and worked for Dennis Coleman and Donald Syme and Ed.
You worked for Ed too, did you?
No.
Because Ed worked for Donald Syme, didn't
he? Sorry, I worked for Dennis Coleman and Ed was working for Don. And the atmosphere between the two was, you'd cut it with a knife. And I thought, well, hell, there must be a place for me in the middle of all this. So I thought, well, I'll have a pharmacy in Havelock North. And then I tried to rent a building which Treacher's had used as a finishing factory for his joinery. It had been a butcher shop prior to that, and it had a dairy next door. I approached Sir Edwin Bate, who was acting for Mrs. Gobie, who owned the premises. He said, "No, you can't rent it, but you can buy it." I said, "Well, Edwin, as he was then, I haven't got the money to buy it." He said, "Well, how much could you find?" And I said, "Well, I have to think about it." So I went back to him and he said, Wolf Lester had made them an offer, a crazy offer of less than government valuation for it. So if I like to consider an offer larger than government valuation, and he told me government valuation was £4,000, Mrs. Gobie would be very happy to hear from me. So I went back to him and said, "Look, Edwin, I can find £400 if I sell my boat that I'd built." He said, "All right." He said, "Well, I'm sure Mrs. Gobie could leave the rest of it in for you." So he arranged the mortgage. I bought the place for £400. I spent 3 months building all my own fixtures, out with a bloke called Bill Merton. Now, Bill was, his kidneys had been affected in the war. Sulfonamides had done the damage. So he was a sort of, he didn't believe he should have to work. So he was quite happy to help me behind the scenes. So he and I literally built all the fittings, ran them to a guy called Ernie Wiggins, and we needed a new veranda because that Christmas one of the kids had been driving around the roundabout, hit the bus, and the bus had finished up underneath the veranda, and the veranda had been demolished. I was able to get insurance for
the demolished veranda,
and Ernie Wiggins put the veranda on the building for no cost to me. So I opened in 64.
Now, you never had a temporary pharmacy.
Yep. So I opened, and I can still remember walking home after 5 days, working it out of my head, and I realised I made a profit, so I was going to stay in business.
And this is when you were living in Tiati Road?
Yep. We were in Tiati Road for about 3 months in Custance House, and Peter Gifford was the solicitor for Custance, and I figured out that it was going to be a touch and go. And Peter Gifford rang me one day and said, "Was I making money? Was I going to be able to pay the rent?" And I said, "Well, Peter, here's the figures." And he said, "Well, you think you're going to be able to pay the rent?" And I said, "Well, I'm not sure." He said, "Well, that doesn't leave us in a very good position." So he's obviously keen to get rid of me as a tenant. And Miss Mary Mossman had offered me a place in Duart Road. So I told Peter Gifford, "Look, you better find another tenant." Customs was very unhappy when Peter Gifford let me go. Peter Gifford judged me a bad bet, which I was very happy about because the rent was half the price with Mary Boston. She was an absolute dear. So that's when I got started. I employed my first shop assistant, who was a Treacher, co-Treacher's daughter, I think what her name was. And I had to repair the roof of the old shops. It was full of holes. And prior to me opening the shop, I knew that I was running low on money. And I needed some help, and I'd been with the ANZ Bank for all my working life, and went to work for Noel Wilson, relieving farm assistant in Hastings. And I worked for Sandy Rogers, who was another pharmacist, two older pharmacists in Hastings. Anyway, I said to Noel one day, look, the ANZ Bank refused to let me have a loan, and I'm going to need some working capital. He said, go and see my bank, National Bank, Murray Graham. Here's your answer. I went around to see Murray Graham, walked in, and Murray Graham said, you're starting a pharmacy? I said, yes. And I said, I've had to buy my land and my building. He said, well, what have you got? And I told him. He said, how much do you want? I said, £1,000. Overdraft or working capital. He said, yep, that's okay, you've got that. I said, well, thank you very much. What do I need to do? I said, that's okay, look, we'll sign the papers later. Now I said, you've got a spare space. There's a sort of an alleyway in that building. He said, how about the bank put a small building in there? And he said, we'll charge it to you, but we'll pay the interest and pay the capital back as rent. How would you feel about that? I said, well, that'd be ticket to boo with me.
Well,
I walked out of there fairly absolutely, mate. Oh. And so they were my debtors for 5 years. Mm. Used to come out there and open the National Bank.
So then you opened that pharmacy, you're living in Duart Road.
Yep, living in Duart Road. And then I'm trying to keep my marriage together and nothing would make Mary happy. I thought, well, I'd buy her a house. And Pauline Tyres, pharmacist in Karamu Road, Andy Duncan had bought his pharmacy off Pauline Tyres in Mahura. I think that's how it goes there. Pauline Tyres was a good friend, and she had a house up the top of Tara Road, which she wanted to sell, and very reluctantly, the insurance company let me have the money to buy Pauline Tyres' house. We moved in, and I added to that using Ernie Wiggins again, and that didn't make anybody any happier, and we paid a company. So I was living there looking after the two children. There was Tim and Catherine. And Tim I used to take down, he was only 8 or 9 months. I used to take him down and he'd spend his day down at the pharmacy.
Mm.
And grew up virtually in the pharmacy until Joyce Mary Church, who had a son born on the same day as Tim, came in one day. She said, look, what's his name? Well, it's Joyce and Peter, but I can't think of the son's name. Anyway, she said, look, can I pick Tim up when you come down each morning, and then he'd come home because Andrew is bored to tears, and he just loves some company. So really, Joyce Mary Church acted for about 18 months, I think, looking after, she was just brilliant. Mm. Tim was so lucky. She was really like another mother to
him. I went away on a couple of camps to Kaitawa with her. No, she was a straight lady.
She was really lovely. I mean, she helped me out of a hole. Anyway, I then remarried Helen, and I decided I got involved with horses. Never ridden in my life, but I'd learnt to ride. And one day I saw a piece of land up Timata Peak Road. I'm not sure how I came to know about it, but Bryce Jones was up there. I saw him on the site, and I stopped, and he said, oh, yes, we've just bought this. And I said, what about the piece in front? He said, oh, I don't know whether that's for sale or not, but we've got this one. We're on the top side. And I went back to Bill Curry, the land agent, and I said to Bill, how about, is there any chance of, what would the price be? And about 3 weeks later, I went back to Bill and said, have you found anything out? And a couple of weeks after that, Bill still hadn't come up with
it. Pretty tired, Bill.
Yeah. Yeah, Peter Morrison working with him. And I was looking at the pharmacy one day, and I saw David Christie walking to the Coffee Bale Cafe across the road. Yeah. So I walked across and said to David Christie, look, is that piece of land for sale? He said, yeah, it's been on the market, no one wants it. How much do you want for it? He said, oh, $12. The back piece was $10, the front piece was $12. He said, I think it's the better piece, but Bryce thinks his piece is best. So he said, yep, $12. I said, I think I could find, when I sell the house, I could find a couple of thousand. And he said, well, okay. He said, that'd be all right if that's what you want to put up. He said, you pay me the rest off. He said, I'm not in any hurry for the money. You go and see Bramble, I think it was, and we get an interest rate, and if you follow it through, it's yours. And that's how I bought
the... And you remarried them.
And so then sold the house and decided, well, there's only one thing to do, and that's to build a barn or something on the site and move in there and then save up some money and build the house. In the event, I built a ski lodge with Len Hoogerbrook, and said to them, look, I'm in a house. So he designed a garage, which was to be part of the house. And I partially built that I'm just trying to think of the block layer's name, Bill, one of the early block layers. Anyway, he came up and laid the blocks, and I filled them and laid the steel and did a lot of the work, and I did a lot of the woodwork on the house. And later on, when I wanted to lay my own concrete blocks, he gave me a certificate to say that I was capable and qualified to lay concrete blocks. Gosh, whoops, he died of a heart attack.
From parallel blocks, was he?
No, he was out in Havelock, the Brookvale Road. His son went on to be a plumber. I should remember that. Anyway, he qualified me to lay concrete blocks, and later on I laid concrete blocks because I had to produce a certificate. I built a swimming pool first up there because I knew that I wouldn't be able to get the concrete truck to the swimming pool later. Mm. And then I built that house entirely myself. I had no help. Oh, the JCs came and laid the concrete floor for me. And the rest of it I did, and I didn't do the tiles on the roof. Then getting back to the shop, I realised that I needed a bigger shop and the dairy needed to be renovated. Things are falling apart a bit. So I managed to raise a loan to build the shops. But the problem was that I had to find alternative premises. And Rod Gallen was my solicitor. It was very hard to find money at the time. And he came back to me and said, look, he said, I've arranged a very, very special loan for you. He said, you're very, very lucky, but you'll have to find alternative premises. So I got Hugenbrook to design me a stable, and I went to the council and said to Bill Ashcroft, look, I want to rebuild. Could I put that stable on the council car park? And old Bill Ashcroft took it to the council, and the council said, yes, we couldn't see any reason why not. So one weekend I turned up with my prefab, which I'd built at home, turned up with my prefab stable, put it together, put the plumbing on and put the water on, the power on, and a week later I shipped it in.
And the car park was?
Exactly where the National Bank is. And I was in there for 6 months, journey.
Now I know exactly where it was.
Yeah, it was the car park, and nobody was using the car park. So here was this land, and I popped it up. Well, that then gave me a chance to demolish the pharmacy building, which I demolished. That part of the building was built first. Ray Dooney did it. It was one of his first jobs he did. He built that and we finished it, and then we shifted the dairy into there, and I built the pharmacy over the driveway, demolished the bank building and built the pharmacy.
So how long were you in your temporary premises then?
Oh, about 6-7 months. Well, then I needed to shift the bank. The bank got sticky at that stage because Murray Graham had gone, and they said, oh, but they still had a lease, and it looked as though it was all going to come to custard. And so I got thinking, a bit of lateral thinking, and there used to be a taxi stand across by where Treacher's were in the middle, and which wasn't used very often. So I said to the bank, if I found you a portable building, would you be happy to operate your enterprise from the portable building? So they reluctantly agreed, and the council agreed to pop the portable building on the taxi.
Your portable building?
Yeah.
So it became the bank office.
The bank. And the same guard used to turn up and stand outside the...
Yeah, but isn't it clever that your mother asked you what you wanted to be? She told you to be a pharmacist first, and then you could be a cabinet maker, which you built.
Yeah.
And not only that, you became a thinker as well.
Oh, yeah, and a builder.
And then you moved back into your new premises.
New premises. And then I sold my prefab stables for 3 times what it cost me to build them. And they came and demolished them, took them away. And then I think something happened on the truck going back. I think something fell off.
Now, it was during this period that you became involved with the Havelock Borough Council, wasn't it? While you were in that pharmacy.
Yeah, it was while I was in the early one, the first one. I had joined JC's, and one of the projects, JC's never did any projects in Havelock. And I said, well, why don't we do a children's playground in Havelock? And they said, well, if you want to do that, you organise a committee and you do the fundraising and you can do it under our banner. So, yeah, it was Peter Morris and myself, a couple of other guys. We raised the money and we did the first upgrade of the children's playground. See, you couldn't buy children's play equipment at that stage, so we had a lot of money. And we'd seen the plane that used to be in Paiatua. My great-grandfather gave that land to the people of Paiatua. As a matter of coincidence, And that was, the blame was on the land he'd gifted.
That was an old harbour.
Yeah. So that's sitting there. So I thought, well, why don't we put a plane down there? Because yes, there must be a plane around somewhere. So I did a bit of research and I found a Grumman Avenger sitting in a paddock. There was a number of planes in Tikawiti where they were building top dressing planes. And I went across there one day and said, any chance of buying it? And they said, well, it's just sitting there and we haven't got anything to do with it. But you'll never fly it. You never do anything. We've stripped it pretty much. I said, I don't need to fly it. How much would you want for it? And they said, well, look, if it's for a children's play area, you can take it away. So then we surveyed the road, and that's when I got to know Harry Remains. And Harry thought it was going to be a great project. So he got one of his old trucks, put a ball on the back of the truck on the tray. We went off and fitted the tail wheel into this fitting, and we towed it backwards.
Did they have the folding wings?
Yeah, they had the folding wings. And we towed it backwards. And then he came back up and then had come over the Taupo Road. We couldn't go through the gorge. We surveyed everything, and the only way we'd come was, and our biggest problem was a little bridge just before you start to climb up. Anyway, we'd get up to about 30 or 40 miles an hour, and the flaps would open. And the whole entourage would slow down. Funnily enough, we didn't have to have an escort. We did our own escorting, and we stayed off one night somewhere along the way. I arranged with television to take an interest and raise some money with them, and they recorded the whole thing all the way through. And each night they would play another update of where this project had got to. So we finally got it back on the playground and set it up, and it was there for some years. And then a restoration crowd down in the hut bought it. So that was my entry to community involvement. Ron Nilsson was the mayor, and Ron agreed that it would be good for Havelock North and supported the idea of the playground. Somebody said, why don't you stand for council? It was when Ron was having a bit of a dysfunctional conversation with Judith Payne. So Ron had been in the firing loan. He said that he was going to put a rubbish dump in the middle of our present. And Judith Payne said, no, he wasn't. And she was rather hot on Ron's tail. They had a public meeting, and Ron was chairing it and explaining that the rubbish dump was a good place to put the rubbish. And Mrs. Payne was on her feet, and Ron, from my memory, said, Mrs. Bloody Payne, these bloody will sit down. And that was the end of Ron as mayor. Bill Ashcroft took up the Judas case, and Ron lost his seat. And funnily enough, Bill Ashcroft then got involved because one of his kids was accused of breaking windows in a toilet block that used to be by the swimming pool. So it was Bill, and so I thought, well, okay, with all this going on, I might as well stand. And so I topped the poll, and the only public speaking I'd had was through JC's. And when I joined JC's, when I first shifted to Hastings, I couldn't even stand up and introduce myself. So all my public speaking was learned through there. I often wondered why I topped the poll, and I mean, people knew pretty much we'd cover the whole of the place with advertising and whatnot, raising money, and I often wondered whether poor old Cyril lent a fair bit of support with his name, Cyril Whittaker, because he was known in the church and community.
No, you were a young new blood. See, you were a chemist.
Just different. The council engaged George Porter, town planner from Wellington, to do the town planning. And Bill Ashcroft really thought he was a waste of time, because Bill's attitude was that, well, we've got to have a town plan by law, but there's no reason why we should ever implement it, because we've got a roundabout and it works very well. George came up with a town plan. I think it took about 3 years to formulate, and finally the council adopted it. And remember Bill Ashcroft saying to me, well, we've got a town plan, but we will never, ever be putting that into practice. So you don't need to worry. As a retailer, you don't need to worry. We're not closing any streets. We're not doing those sort of things. We can't afford it anyway. Well, Bill decided to, because I was his deputy mayor, I think it was Harold Christie was deputy mayor the first time, and then the next term I stood, topped the poll again, consequently finished up as deputy mayor. So when Bill Ashcroft retired, I thought, I'll put my name up, and again topped the poll. Poor old, he thought he was a shoo-in, and he never really forgave me for putting him out. He's a nice guy. So I think as a result, he went off to Hong Kong and plays a judge over there. So the first thing I did, first council meeting, I said, right, we're going to implement the town plan. And I don't know whether some of the councillors quite knew what it involved, but I had a lot lined up, including Kepi Hiru, and he was right in my pocket. And mind you, I was doing a good job, so why wouldn't he be? And so we resolved that we would implement the first stage of the town plan, and old Constantine said, yep, it was all go. He could raise the money. And so the first stage was outside the supermarket. Mm-hmm. So in other words, we owned the land, which was the council yard. So it was just a matter of we could make some money by selling some of the land and we'd get started. So I think within 3 months, they had the tractor out there, the excavator, and I drove the tractor for the first site. I remember doing the big scoop, it was outside the supermarket. So that was the start. And it was sort of accepted, and we had to do the next stage, which involved closing streets outside Gilmore's and everything. And I went to a council meeting to meet the retailers, and there was about 45 retailers there. Council chambers were packed. None of my councillors would sit up the front with me. They all sat down the back, and the retailers abused the hell out of me. It just, the catcalls and the yahooing and the put-me-downs, and I thought, this is idiotic. I mean, in my book, you had to have a town plan, and you needed to have some more parking area, and it was a jolly good town plan. I walked down the street the next morning, and Ed Gilmore came up to me, and I said, hi, Ed. He spat on my feet. That's the feeling that was out there. It was shocking. I couldn't believe these guys. Idiots. We've got the chance to do something. Yeah, here we've got the chance to do something really good. And here these...
But I mean, that was the reason that you were elected mayor.
Well, I think so.
Yeah. The people were ready for it. It was fun for you.
So anyway, I wasn't put off. My thought was, well, you'll be dead and you won't be worrying about it anyway. And the Bob Prater, he was against it. Ewing wasn't too bad. But anyway, there was a whole group of them. This is idiotic. Anyway, we proceeded. In the end, when I decided I'd had enough, and I had to fight Harry Remains every inch of the way. Harry was adamant that we weren't going to proceed any further, but I think Kepi Uru kept on popping the vote in the right place. Mm. But it got around to the point where we'd put the ring road, we'd put Porter Drive right around to where my pharmacy is now, but we didn't connect the piece up in front of the church. And I said to George in my last meeting, I said, look, George, that has to happen because you need that connection. You need to have that flow. Oh, I said, you don't need to convince me. I drew it. He said, we're going to do it. And I said, how the hell are you going to get past Harry Remains and Shanley? And he said, leave it to me. And 3 months later, came up, they were going to put a car park out there. And of course, what do you put in a car park? You put a road.
That's amazing. A lot of us didn't know what was going on behind the scenes. You know, we knew that there were some struggles going on within the council, but it never surfaced.
Most of the time it was fairly reasonable. You know, I sat on a lot of councils. Margaret Hursthouse, I made my deputy mayor when I got elected. Perhaps it was a mistake, but Margaret would have liked to be mayor. And she was pretty helpful for a couple of terms, but Margaret had a bit of ill health, and I had to tell her one day, perhaps she should take 3 months off.
Those people that wanted to stand were standing for the glory of being there rather than doing something for the community.
Oh, I think that's what it was.
So then, once you've got that little Columba Way, I think it's called now, once you got that through...
Well, I didn't get it through. George Porter did. And I think the council owes, or the people of Havelock North owe George a huge amount of praise and thanks, because without him you wouldn't have the Havelock you've got today. He had the foresight. I mean, when we were trying to establish that car park outside Ed Gilmore's, the opposition to closing the road, it was just phenomenal.
While you were involved as the mayor, you instigated several reasonably big projects in the committee. One of them mainly was the library.
Well, the library, I'd suggested it to Bill Ashcroft and Bill said, oh, we've had 3 lone poles. It's never going to be a goer. So the second council meeting, I think I said, I think we should build a library. It was pretty lukewarm. But Colin Shanley,
Peter Cale?
Yes, to a degree.
Yes, he wasn't totally.
No, Peter ran with Harry, and if Harry said no, well, Peter said no. So, it was Shanley and Margaret Hirsthouse were my main supporters. Anyway, my thing to them was, look, if we raise, and it was when Fowler was building the Fowler Centre in Wellington, and I thought, well, if he can do it, so can I. How about we raise some money, and we can raise a substantial amount, we'll build the library. So then Harry wanted to, he thought he could do the plans for the library, and there was a lot of dissent there, and I said, no, come on, let's get a decent architect. And I guess I won a divided council over using Len Hildebrand. But, I mean, Len's ideas were as good as the next architect. And then came up with the plans for the library, and then community centre, and then an auditorium. And I said to Len, well, I think we could do the community centre and the auditorium. And basically that community centre is very much like Len did in the first place. And Shanley did a plan, not a plan, a model of the library. And he brought along to a meeting. It's beautiful. He'd done a fantastic job. Amazing with the community centre. And he popped it on his trailer to go home, or van or whatever, and it blew up. The bank was demolished, which is such a shame. We had all sorts of fundraisers.
Colin was a Rotarian then, and he came along and he floated the idea, would the Rotary Club like to become involved as a major fundraiser for the Jeff Whittaker's new library? Yeah. Colin and I both said, okay, well, we'll go along and we'll join the thing. And there was the most wonderful friendship was amongst
young. Well, I got to know you. And
young and old. And
yeah, and when you think about it, it involved the whole community. Oh.
Well, when I think, you know, we had most of the Goldies from Wellington, paintings there.
Yep. Oh, thank you. The art
festival. We had all the beautiful pottery from all over New Zealand. And it was just incredible. And, you know, we did the Thoroughbred 79 or something.
With all the cups.
We had every cup and every ribbon for New Zealand. No, Hawke's Bay. But, you know, we raised so much. But the interesting thing was the numbers of people that wrote to the paper and said we didn't want the council to borrow any more money. Solicitors, some of our well-known.
We got a judge in here.
And they were the first people to use it.
What happened was we resolved to, well, we raised the money. We raised $60,000, and I thought that was a good, no, sorry, 90. And I thought that was a good amount of money to float it. And we still had all these negative people, so I figured we'd lost the loan poll. I think it was three times that had to go, and we weren't going to lose again. So I timed the resolution for the last council meeting in December, and I said it was very important that we advertise this thing on the 20th of December, so it would just follow, and it would give nobody a chance to have a loan poll petition. I went in to see Bob Dick on about the 20th of January. Bob was back from his holiday, and I said to Bob, do you have a good holiday? Yes, I said, have we any objections to the loan? Oh, damn it, says Bob. Forgot to do it. So we advertised it, and Richard got back from America, and Richard said, oh, the hell with this, I'm not having this on my bloody rates.
Have a paper about it.
Yeah, I'm going to have a petition. He organised a petition. They had a petition, was only had 10% of the ratepayers, and he got it all right. So we had to have a poll. Well, I knew we'd frigging lose. So I went to Len Hugenbrook and said, look, Len, you've got paid for your plans. How about doing me another plan? I know, I think, we can raise 180, we'd raise 120. We can raise 180,000, and that's going to stop us. You get paid if the library goes ahead. If the library doesn't go ahead, you lose. And he said, oh, I'm betting on you. He said, I'll do that for you. And I said, can't cost more than that, 180. And he said, all right, I'll do the plans for you. So it was the night of the loan poll, and we're all around at Margaret Hirsthouse's, and Bob Dick came in, long faces, oh, you lost by 22 votes. I think we lost because of you. And he said, oh, well, that's the end of the library. And Margaret Hirsthouse is in tears. And Marion Moss, I think, was on the committee then. She was in tears, and Vivian Williams. Anyway, the women were all in tears, and the boys were having another beer. And Harry said, oh, well, that's it. The public don't want it. And I said, oh, I don't agree with you, Harry. And I went to the piano, And I pulled out the new set of plans.
Help the library.
Help the library. And Harry nearly choked. Oh dear. Anyway, I said, well, let's build this library. We won't build a community centre, just the library. And Harry said, oh, no, the ratepayers have voted. The ratepayers have said what they want to say. And Margaret Hurstow said, oh no, do you think we could do it? I said, well, there's the plans. So it took me 6 weeks of council meetings. I put every argument I could find.
We were just so grateful that you were working. But for the community, you weren't working for yourself.
It had to happen. So anyway, Alan B was my deputy town clerk. And I called a special council meeting and I got stuck in and said, look, we've got to do it. And I'll guarantee you, the council prepared to guarantee the loan, $60,000. I'm sure we could do it over 3 years on rates. I'll undertake to raise the rest of the money. And Harry was adamant it wasn't going to happen. Colin was in his pocket and Peter Cale, there were all three of them. And it looked, when I counted up, it looked as though I was going to lose. And 2.5 hours, I think it was, and I sat down and I said, it was a prayer, look, Lord, I've done my bit. I've done everything I could do. And I'm sitting there. And Alan B said afterwards, he said, it was just electric. You're sitting there, not saying anything. And he said, he looked up and Harry Romaine stood up and he said, oh, he said, I think we could do this. He said, I think there could be some money coming out of the community. Yeah, he said, I would move the motion that we proceed. And I'm bloody Harry saying, what the hell are you doing? And Peter Cale voted for it. And within 30 seconds,
the whole thing had swung.
It was done. Unbelievable. And then I went home and I said to Ellen, I said, what happened? She said, well, so long as you don't interfere, I'm prepared to run, I think it was a swimathon. And when did we do the medieval fair? That was before.
That was done in the same pattern of things.
That was before though, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
I mean, that was a fantastic event. Dinner, where they had the dogs and the threw the bones over there. Margie McKenzie came to see me the next day and she said, oh, she said, that was a wonderful time. She said, we really loved it. She said, I can't understand why I got blisters in my mouth. And I said, I can remember. I said, you're eating lit candles.
You know, the day it opened, it was the most wonderful thing for the village.
For the village, yeah. Mm. But no, what Helen did, she said, I'll run a garden party up at the place of the Peak. I'll invite all those people you've said you've contacted, all the dames of Havelock. And she said, you leave it to me. And I did. It was a beautiful day. She laid it all out. It was flowers, the lot. And old Alan B and Lomas on the council. Yeah. And two or three of them came up, all dressed in dinner suits and served on the tables. I came home at 4 o'clock and all the old girls are still sitting out there saying, this just takes us back so many years. And the next day, the phone went and they said, it was Webb, I think. Said, oh, the Nelson Trust want to give you $20,000. And within the week, the money was there. Just incredible. Just blew me away. I wondered why I didn't say, well, we'd build a community centre. Yeah, it was just, the money just arrived. Yes. So it was just great to see it opened.
So after that, how much longer did you serve as mayor?
Well, then, I mean, there was Guthrie Park was another one. Now, I fought Remains over that. I wanted to buy it. The county council said, no, you can't have it. I said that it was no worth to them, and Guthrie wanted to sell it to us. Guthrie had been on our backs for years. And finally, I got the council to agree to buy it, even though it was still in the county land. And then I was instrumental in building the changing rooms down there. And bloody Romaine shoves his frigging name on it. He was opposed to the frigging thing. Anyway, I mean, Harry. Harry was Harry. There was, Anderson Park. I had a lot to do with getting that land down there.
Kairanga Gardens. That was during the Ron Wilson's.
No. Kairanga Gardens. Ron had turned it down. It was offered. And Bill Ashcroft said, well, we had a meeting and it was agreed that we would put some money up for it. No, they would gift the land, but we had to buy the buildings. And Bill Ashcroft wasn't going to buy the buildings. And Margaret Hurstow and I got on to Bill and said, we've got to buy it. And we bought it. And there's a bit more to that tale, because there's a bit of land adjacent to it, which we...
Don't you have to cover some of the gift duties as well?
Yes, there was a deal. Anyway, we bought it. Well, you know, that was before Harry got involved, though. And then Duart House was another one that Bill was involved with.
Did you retire from council?
No, I retired. What happened was we had a meeting. They decided they were going to bring in 3-hectare or 3-acre blocks and they were going to cover the peak with it or wherever they could find it. And I said, look, that's a bit unfair because I've created building platforms, so they're going to charge me rates on the basis of building platforms. And I went along to a hearing as an individual. It was at the old Tiamata pub. And Watson turned up, Richard turned up, and he was working on behalf of somebody. He stood up and in a tirade of about 10 minutes, said what a shocking mess the council had made of Havelock North, what a shocking place it was. All the town planning was crap, went on and on and on. I walked out of that meeting, I went home and resigned. I said, that's it, I'm not standing here. That's all your effort can bring. I thought, you're destructive.
Isn't it funny that men like that end up judging other people?
Yeah, he stopped the library, and here he stopped me. I thought, no, he's still a mate. But I thought, what was the negativity?
Yeah, so during that period then, of course, you had 2 more sons.
Yep, it was Michael and Paul. Havelock North was always struggling to get land, and the Hawke's Bay County Council believed that they had the divine right to restrict expansion. And we did several petitions to them to get them to change their minds, and Mick Broom was always adamant that we weren't going to get any more land. So Palmer, Robert decided, I think he actually owned land in Harataki Road, and I went to the county council and said, look, why can't we have Harataki Road? It's unproductive, and it wouldn't take any productive land out. And the town clerk or the county clerk said, no, you can't have that. And I said, well, what about Durham Drive? I mean, that just ties up to the top there. It's useless land. And the clerk said, yes, you can have Durham Drive. And I'm sort of looking at him. I'm thinking, I don't know whether he knows what he's saying. Yeah, he said, no, Durham Drive, we can lose that. And I said, well, what about Harataki Road? He said, no, you can't have Harataki Road. And I said, well, you know, the land is useless. No, that's it. Well, they gave us Durham Drive, and then afterwards I was talking to Mick Groom. He said, gee, bloody Whitaker, we didn't know that Durham Drive was Durham Drive. We didn't intend to give you Durham Drive. Because they didn't even know where Durham Drive was. So we had Durham Drive, and we had the triangle running down Graham Lowe's province was in contention. But we couldn't do anything with Graham Lowe's because you had to pump the sewage up the hill. So Palmer was pretty chuffed with the fact we had Durham Drive because he owned a lot of it. And the next thing I got to hear through Richard Mason, the MP, that the government was going to take Durham Drive off Palmer and they were going to take Graham Lowe's lot and they were going to do an integrated housing for Havelock North. And I thought, that's the last thing. Here we are. We've just managed to get Durham Drive some decent housing land, and you're going to do that to us. So I went down to a meeting with Douglas, and I had Alan B with me. And I can't remember whether it was, I think it was Heath. It was 3 of us. We went down and we met with Richard Mason. We went into the minister's office. And in the meantime, I'd arranged a contract with Palmer to ownership of a small amount of shares. The council would buy these shares if the development went ahead. But we had a contract. So we, in actual fact, were tenants in common with the large bit of the land with Palmer. So Douglas was sitting at his table. We walked in. He knew what we were coming about. And he continued to sign papers and work away for about 5 minutes. Richard Mason was jumping from one foot to the other, coughing and spluttering and trying to get the minister's attention. Lifted his head. Finally, he said, what are you here for? And I said, oh, how do you do? I'm Jeff. I'm introduced to ourselves. Yes, he said, I know. And I said, well, we're just here to, we want to talk about the land adjacent to Havelock. He said, oh, well, he said, no, that's a foregone conclusion. He summed up the plans. The plans are already underway. We're going to be doing integrated community housing on this land. I said, no, well, it's not the interest of Havelock North. He said, I don't care about Havelock North. So this is what we're going to be doing, because it was a political thing. Mm. Richard Mason was as embarrassed as anything, and I said to the minister, well, you can't take land off the local authority. He said, it's not the local authority, though. I'm taking it off Palmer. I said, No, you're not. We've got a contract with Palmer. We get paid a certain percentage of the development. And I said, there's the contract. He said, that's not possible. I said, well, it is possible. That's what I'm here to tell you, that you're not going to be doing that to us. Oh, well, he said, if I can't do that, I'll be doing the piece the other end. And I said to him, well, okay, well, I have to tell you there's $1 million involved with the pumping station, pumping sewage, back up the road to Havelock before it runs downhill out to sea. He said, is this right? He turns around to his minions behind him and said, is that correct? And they said, well, we're not sure. And they said, oh, we can check pretty quickly. So we're left standing in this, we weren't offered a seat. We're left standing in this minister's office. They came back within 5 minutes and said, oh, Mr. Whitaker is quite correct. The land is below Havelock North and it would require a pumping station. And Douglas never said anything. He just put his head down and started to sign stuff. Mason said after a few minutes, Mr. Minister, well, what's the answer? Oh, he said, I haven't got an answer. Didn't even say goodbye to us. He walked out of his office. And that's the only reason that Havelock North has retained its character. Ah, oh, that was one of the biggest battles, and of course Mick Green was the other one. We needed a rubbish dump, and I don't know whether you remember, we decided we'd put one up at Glen Park Place, right in the hills there. And I thought, yeah, this is a go. I mean, we could fill that in, we'd slope the hill off nicely. And I remember going up there to meet the residents, and there would be 50 to 100 residents all out there, nice and up in a fence post, and told them, I'm going to put a rubbish dump up their road.
Well, I remember our request. You remember that big hall there? Because my uncle, Lindsay Wilson, was the one that used to take the spoil and fill it up. And when it was finished, they had this beautiful... No one complained with that beautiful level.
Oh, but Judith Payne did.
I know she did.
I was in the pharmacy one day, and I always used to hide my money. I didn't have a safe. I used to hide my money in the rubbish tin. And one of the guys that called him, he got pretty helpful, and he picked up the rubbish behind my back and had thrown it on the rubbish truck. Suddenly I realised all my week's takings had gone out for the rubbish, and I finished up the rubbish dump up the hill, going to rubbish bags.
Did you find it?
Yeah, found money. So the last lot was tipped off. Yeah, so anyway, Glen Park Place wasn't the go, and we said to Hawke's Bay County Council, well, where can we go? And they said, well, you can go to Black Bridge, because we've got a dump there. So we said, well, how much will it cost us? And they said, oh, certain percentage or whatever it was, that's fine. Well, the first bill came in, Dudley Hawkes was the engineer. It was four times what they'd suggested to us. And I stood up in the council meeting and said that they'd given Dudley Hawkes an open checkbook. Ridiculous. He had no controls placed over him. He wasn't going to spend our money like that. Well, headlines in the paper the next day weren't particularly complimentary from the county council. So I went to an airport meeting at the county council chambers, walked in there, and there were three county councillors in the meeting, just me and the reps from Hastings. Anyway, we had the meeting. I'm just about to leave, and they shut the door on me. So I was locked up with Mick Groom and three of their county councillors, and they told me in uncertain terms that I was going to apologise to Dudley Hawkes before I left the... their room.
You were a rebel with a cause, weren't you?
And I said, there's no way that I'm going to be leaving this room with an apology for Dudley Hawkes, even if it takes me all down. You're not getting one, because that's what he's got. Yeah. Anyway, in the end, I opened the door and left. Never did apologise, and that's what they did. They literally loaded all their costs onto us. Yeah. So the next big fight was we needed our sewage. We had tanks, remember? We needed to connect up to the sewerage down, which they're just replacing now. Yes,
what the two.
And Bert Sellers had decided that we were going to pay a certain sum of money based on peak flows. And I said to Bert, look, that's unfair, because you're not charging yourself on peak flows. All your calculations for Hastings are done on minimal flows, and you're charging Havelock on... And Bert said, oh, no, that's the way it's going to be. I mean, Bert and I go along pretty well together. Anyway, that's how it's going to be. And I said, no, we're not going to wear that. So I went along to a council meeting with Hastings City, and I put up the figures that I had worked out. Sands, was it? Keith worked the figures out for me, and I took Keith the figures on Hastings Council and said, that's what we put down our sewer. If it floods, well, we can't help the flood water going down, but that's basically our sewer. they had to change their whole calculation. It cut the cost to have Lock North by half, all because I was prepared to battle with
Keith.
Yeah, and the next one that Hastings thought we had was over a barrel was over amalgamation, because we needed water. And Harry was hell-bent on amalgamation. He and Magazine, it was undermining. It was just, I just sort of felt, well, hey, if you live in Havelock, at least you could be independent and be for Havelock. But anyway, Harry and Magazine had worked out this deal where we could get water provided we amalgamated. And Keith Sands tried everywhere for us. We put down wells, we investigated wells, we looked at aquifers, and it looked like we were going to be stymied. And then Russell Robertson came into my pharmacy one day, and he said, Whitaker, do you want some water? And I said, oh, we'd love some water. Well, he said, I've just done a well, and we've got more water than you'd ever believe coming up this well down in Brookvale Road. He said, come down and have a look. And we went down, and there's just water everywhere. And I said to Russell, well, how do we get it? Well, he said, it's yours if you want it. He said, but I need a few easements and things like that. And I went back to Keith Sands and said to him, look, I think I've got the water. And Keith said, nah, you haven't got any water. I said, will you come down and have a look? No. He said, there's no water down there. Mm-hmm. And finally, I convinced them all to go down and have a look. And they did some tests. Comes from Tukituk, I think. Mm-hmm. And that's where we got our water. But it was only because through Russell Robertson and his generosity. So, you know, they were the major big projects.
Yes, but, you know, to the community, was probably only 6,000-7,000 those days.
Well, I think it was, when I retired, it was up around 10.
Well, it's at 12 now.
Yeah, well, it's mostly more if you're taking the county.
No, I'm talking about the village.
Yes. Well, what George Porter used to say was, when you get to 14,000, you'll have sufficient parking for 14,000. And if Hastings hadn't, when they took over, if they hadn't sold off that extra block of parking, we would have had parking for 14,000.
So then, once you'd retired from council, you were still running your pharmacy, you still had your children and Helen. What happened next?
Well, actually, there's a piece we must jump to. I'd only just opened my pharmacy, and one of the things that used to make Mary happy was skiing. And I thought, well, let's go skiing, but you couldn't get into the Hawke's Bay Ski Club, they were full. And then the event, I put an ad in the paper, and 120 people turned up to St. Luke's, and we formed the Havelock Ski Club. And Len Hoogerbrook was there, and he said, I'll design it as my contribution. And we formed the club. I worked out financing for if everybody made a contribution. And then I went to the Lotteries Grants Board and finished up with the biggest grant that was ever given to a sporting body. Len did the plans. We engaged Jeff Treacher to build it. I did all the contracting. I did all the organising for everybody to get up the mountain, the materials to assist, and we opened the thing only owing the contributions to the members. Yeah, so that sort of was sort of on the way. And after that, I'd had my dash and local bodies, and Helen came home one day and said she'd like to establish a garden centre. And I could see no reason why she shouldn't. And she'd figured out there was one nursery that was for sale, Wilson's Nursery. Mm. So I went and had a look and thought, well, yeah, okay. Always had a bit of a green hand. I planted enough plants up to Marta Peak Road. Was worth a go. And we sold the peak and bought the garden centre. We offered Wilson's a crazy price. Well, he was dead. And funnily enough, all our plants that are planted up to Marta Peak, including the redwoods on the roadside, all came from Wilson. Wilson imported the seed for those redwoods, and I planted them in the roadside because I had horses. And I thought, oh, I'll just pop them over the fence and I'll be all right. Well, look at them now. They're iconic trees. Yeah, I planted something like 2,000 shrubs and trees on that property. And I remember planting the great number of them, and poor old Bryce Jones telling me that one day they'd block his view. Unfortunately, they did.
Garth Thornton bought Bryce's property, and Garth could always look across your trees and still see the view. Because I don't know whether it was by accident that you kept those trimmed or what.
Yeah, we did. We did. Bryce was most unhappy when we planted. He came home one day, been away, and he came home after the weekend. He said, oh, what are those? I said, they're birches. Bryce didn't think it was funny. Yeah, so we did the garden centre. The nurseryman wouldn't let me join up to their association because I wasn't a nurseryman. And 2 years later, they asked me if I would take apprentices on, which I did do. He couldn't buy any treatises on propagating many plants, and I wrote a manual propagating 700 different varieties and species. We propagated an enormous amount of stuff. We had 3 acres of standing propagation. Anyway, I then built the garden centre, and then I built like the building with the help from Peter Carroll. And then I went next door, because Helen took over the garden centre, and I built the house next door with Peter Carroll. And things fell to pieces, and had to sell the garden centre, I think, after 2 years of her management. Which, you know, was predictable, never mind, another phase. I bought another garden centre, well, established another garden centre in Waipaka House, so the nursery was virtually supplying 2 garden centres, and that was a very, very, very profitable part of it. Anyway, I finished up in Parliament, and...
Yes, you were the MP for Hastings those days, weren't you?
I spent 3 years, 87 to 90, politicking. I tried to knock Butcher out the first time and missed out, so gave him another go and then certainly knocked him out, much to his surprise. But that was 3 of the most wasted years of my life, I think.
Of course, during this period, you had re-established your shop in Havelock, hadn't you?
Oh, no. The shop was still up in Timota Road. And what really triggered things was I asked Maurice Williamson if I could work on the health portfolio. And they were revamping pharmacy at the time. And I said, could I work on that because I could give them some insights? And the committee, which was mainly public servants, continued to exclude me, in spite of what Maurice Williamson was saying. Anyway, I went to Bolger, and Bolger said, right, that's rubbish. He instructed that I was to be on the committee. So I went to my first committee meeting at 4 o'clock, and at 6 o'clock they came, I was sitting outside the door. 6 o'clock they came and said, oh, we're going off for a meal now, but come back at 7 o'clock and we'll some matters we want you to discuss. So at 7 o'clock they let me back in and they said, oh, now would you like to tell us your ideas on revamping pharmacy? I said, hey, but I'm supposed to be on this committee. So I know we only want to hear from you as your thoughts. I went back to Bolger, so this is a bloody waste of time. I'm not going to waste my time doing that. And I thought, well, and then on the resource management bill, I sat there for 2 years listening to all that rubbish. In the end, I said to Bolger, this is crazy. The Resource Management Act is just going to get people into deep water. I think it's just a bureaucratic nightmare. I'm not going to vote for it. And he said, well, you can't not vote for it. Well, I was abstained. So I abstained from voting for the resource management bill. And then there was another bill, the Consumer Guarantees Bill. I sat on that for 2 years, and I said in the end that it needed amendment. It had been the melting pot for 7 years, and the very things I complained about and were opposed to have been changed now. Said to Bolger, it needs to be changed. He said, oh no, he said, Catherine O'Regan's looking out for it. I said, no, it needs to be changed. Anyway, Gisborne MP, who had whiskies with Bolger every Friday night, he went along, Wayne Kimber, he went along for one meeting and saw the same thing as I did. He went to Bolger, stood up at the meeting, and Bolger said, oh, what do you think, Wayne? Wayne told him exactly what I said, and Bolger said, well, I think we should refer it back to committee. I thought, I've spent 2 years, and I'm not drinking with Bolger. And I don't get a look, and I said, that's it, I'm finished. It just wasn't worth it. So, yeah, but while I was there, I got involved with the wine fraternity, mainly through horticulture and wanting to understand it. And we became the wine, Thorn and I used to sit together. We became the wine committee and grape growing committee. And we went down as part of a tourism committee to Queenstown to see what government could do to promote tourism in Queenstown. And we went to Alan Brady, for the winery down there, and we had lunch there. And I said to Alan Brady, look, I'd like a bottle of your wine. He said, no, you can't have it. He said, I can take the cork out and stick your finger in it if you like, but I can't sell you one on Sunday. I said, this is crazy. He said, no, that's the law. I said, well, can you give me the cork? He said, I'll give you the cork. I'll pull it and you put it back. And so I got a bottle of wine off Alan Brady. So I went back and said to Thorne, look, let's have a change of this. So the result was I put through a private member's bill and it went before a select committee, and I was told it was too selective and we included fruit wines and the fact that wineries could sell wine on Sundays and fruit wine could be sold from supermarkets. And West Select Committee, because it was so narrow, came back and Braybrook was on the other side. He said to me, "You've got a lot of wankers in your lot." And he said, "I've got some of mine." He said, "Those wowsers get to hear that the bill's going up." He said, "It's going to be on for a long time. So if you get a draw," it had to come up as a draw. Mm. "If you get it drawn, make sure it's got to be a Wednesday night." So anyway, up it came to be referred back from the committee. And I told Braybrook, he said, "Right." He said, "All my guys, I've just given them all the night off. Now that's the wowsers." He said, "Now, what I suggest you do," this is Jeff Braybrook, yeah, he said, "you get down there and stand up when it's called, stand up, and what you say is, I move the second and third readings to be held in conjunction." And he said, "Sit down." And he said, "I'll second it." So it's exactly what happened. And nobody objected. If anybody objected, it would have had to go to third reading and most of them got lost. Well, the door swung open, there's people dashing in from all sorts of areas. Yeah, too late. And the result was that Thorne and I had to speak for 3 hours on this wine bill. And we passed it. So it meant that wineries in the country could sell wine on Sundays. Yeah. That gave them a jump for 6 years.
So you resigned.
Retired.
Now, at some stage, when did you transfer from Tomato Road to your new...
Oh, so then when I was in Parliament, I got to hear that they were going to franchise pie shops. And I did a bit of inquiry and found out that Havelock North was... And the reason they were going to wind Havelock North down was that they had a manager there that they couldn't move. And he insisted on sitting at the back and doing nothing, and their wages bill was out through the roof. I mean, we've employed him. Relieving. Anyway, I went to, and said I'd be interested in franchise because I was leaving Parliament. He said, no. He says, "That's too political. Can't do that." I said, okay. So I retired, went straight to New Zealand Post and said, "Look, how about Havelock North?" They said, "Well, we're thinking about it. Masterton and you, Empire Tour." I said, "Well, I'll be interested." So I went down to see them and they said, "Well, okay, we want to get rid of it. Make us an offer. We want $120,000. I said, "Nah." I said, "60 might be closer to it." They said, "Right, it's yours." And I said, "Well, I'd like to take over your old post shop." And they said, "No, we think we'd like to rebuild." So I said, "Well, I'll come up with plans." Paris Magdalena's came up with plans to shift the pharmacy and the post shop all on the post shop site. And they would own the building. Well, there's a fellow called Alexander there who was the properties manager. He hit it on the head and drew things out. And finally, one of the guys rang me up from New Zealand Post and said, "Why don't you go it alone? So you find somebody who will build you a building and we'll go with you." So that's when I got a hold of Ray Smith. And I had tried to buy Treacher's lot. In fact, I'd made them an offer. They'd accepted, subject to a valuation, went to Long, and Long did the valuation. And within 2 days, Smith had made a counteroffer. And it was completely under the table. Nobody knew. And Long sold me out too. So I dropped out. So I had to go to Ray and I said, "Ray, I want you to build me a shop." And Ray said to me, "I've heard you're the most difficult to deal with." I said, "Yep, I am." So we agreed to meet and I told him what we wanted. He came back to me within 10 days. "There's the plan." He said, "Will you take this space?" I said, "Yep, this will be the rental." "Yep." He said, "You're not such a bad bastard after all." And Ray and I got along like the house on fire. So that's why we shifted in 1995.
And then you furthered your wine connoisseur in business to Shepherd's Bush.
Shepherd's Croft. I decided that I didn't want to stick only in pharmacy. I thought it'd be a bit of fun to grow some grapes. So I went out, I'm just trying to think of the guy's name. You found the land for me. What's his name?
Twig.
Twig sold us the land and away we went. And I rang up, tried to get some plants that first year and got a hold of Corbin, who grew them. And Corbin said, "What do you want?" And I said, "I don't have a clue." Corbin said, "This is what I grow. Send me what you can." Where it all came from.
And it's funny that that block you're on is one of the best blocks of grape land that was around.
Yep, and it still is.
I know. It has a good mix of shingle and silt.
Yep. Growing grapes. So then I went out there and built another house, laid the concrete floor, laid all the concrete blocks. Paris designed that one, laid all the concrete blocks one winter, laid the concrete floor, end of the wine season the next year. Up the house went again with Peter Carroll. He, lovely guy. I worked with Shannon Sexton on this house. Steve Miller had been my electrician all the way through. And Steve said to me, you're looking for a builder. Peter Carroll's not available, but Dennis Sexton's your man. And he's a very, very good builder. He'll annoy the shit out of you. He won't come until 10 o'clock in the morning. You'll want to work till it's dark. But if you can live with that, he said he's one of the best guys around. So Shannon said, yep, I'll come and work. And Shannon had done a house for David Remains, I think. And David had, or Harry had altered the plans going through, changed the building quite substantially. And Shannon had gone out on his own just prior to building this house, which sent Shannon broke. And Tumu's bailed Shannon out. So Shannon was paying off Tumu's. He'd done a beautiful job on the house. They all agreed the house was perfect, but he didn't have the contract signed, so Harry said he wasn't going to pay. He sort of connects up.
So then, you know, once you enjoyed Shepherd's Croft, during this period of time, you had a yacht. You've always had a yacht.
Yeah, I did have a yacht. I had a yacht. Michael and I bought a, well, I bought it, but Michael with me, bought a Beneteau in 1992, which we had chartered in the Sounds. And then I had it up in Auckland, and Dave Soares, my accountant, filed an application for a qualifying company for taxation. I asked him to file it in February, and he didn't file it till July. Didn't know anything about it. 2 years later, the tax department came along and said, you can't claim all the development costs of the vineyard because you're not a qualified, you haven't qualified, and you owe us $127,000. And I went to Dave Soares, oh, no, no, he said, that wasn't my fault. No, no, no. Now I've got a special tax lawyer in. No, no, we think we can get out of it. I went to see the IRD, and they said, we'll have a special meeting. And the IRD guy came around and said, we can find a legitimate way to let you off the hook. We will. It has to be legitimate. We are totally sympathetic towards you. It's not your fault. But he said, you're tied into this. I sold my yacht because I didn't want to be stuck. Anyway, we went to this meeting with Dave Soares' office, and he had his solicitor there, his solicitor in IRD, and I said to the IRD guy, I think I might have sat on this bill. Can I have a copy of the bill? So I said to David, you've got the bill there, can I have your copy? And David said, no, 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 I'll go and get your copy. And while he was out, I grabbed his copy, and he had marked for the clause was that if you alter your shareholding of those companies within 3 months, it becomes not binding. It changed the whole thing. I had given Dirt 1% of the shares as I formed the company. The IRD got up, two of them, they walked around and they shook my hand and they said, you're just the luckiest man alive. Because, I mean, I pulled it out for them. They said, congratulate you. You should do something about your accountant and walked out. They do those sort of things. And then I tried to recover my costs from Dave Soares, and no, there was no solicitor in Hawke's Bay that would take him on. So he was protected. But yeah, he was supporting me selling my yacht. Anyway, we had a very good year in the year 2000, and I bought the yacht I've got now.
So what's that?
That's a 45-foot Laurie Davidson yacht, and I've sailed 34,000 nautical miles on it. Yeah.
So where did you have time to do your, what do they call it, your nautical tickets?
And that just is accumulation of experience. I had to sit an exam before I charter the yacht, and I had to sit an exam in Picton. Oh, you know, sort of as a emergency at sea, and you had to tell them how you get there and what sort of allowance you make for current and all the rest of it. You know, I passed that in an engineering exam. And
so then you're off on another adventure. You're sailing in the islands with your sons and sailing around the islands with your beloved and your sons.
Yep.
And you've disposed of Shepherd's Croft, and now you're living in the most glorious home overlooking Eskdale. Looks great.
Michael bred the pheasants. We released six first year we were here, and one cock was a melanistic, which is a green one. He disappeared. I think someone either shot him or captured him to breed from. But the other one was back here the other day. He's been here 4 years.
Now, just coming back to Beverly. Beverly, I know, is from South Africa. Can you just tell me a little bit about Beverly? Are you listening, Beverly?
I'll try to, yeah. You know it better than me.
You have a daughter, you've told me that. She's in her 30s.
Yep, two grandsons.
Beverly came into my life about 7 years ago. We met dancing. Beverly's from Cape Town. She followed her daughter out here to New Zealand. She's what they call Cape Coloured, and Cape Coloureds are recognised to be the first settlers in Cape Town. They were there before the blacks. They can trace their ancestry back to Indonesia. The Dutch had the Bantam Wars. The leaders that opposed the Dutch, the Malaysians that opposed the Dutch, was off down to Cape Town, and they established the East India Trading Company, and they met up with people called the Xhosa, who were natives to the area, the Hottentots. So that was in the 1600s. Beverly, his great-grandfather was English. His name was Ratcliffe. He came up from England and wanted to marry a Muslim, but Ratcliffe wouldn't do the honours, so he changed his name to Rycliffe. So Beverly's descendant from Rycliffe. So, yeah, they talk about the blacks being the settlers, but they weren't the settlers, it was the colours.
Right, and so you have a daughter in Auckland?
Yep, mm-hmm. And two grandchildren.
You have one son who's a photographer still?
Yep.
You have one son who's a professional fungus grower?
Yep.
And your youngest?
He was a farmer, he's now sold his farm and he's working for a fox farm in Pomeroo.
And your daughter?
My daughter's, well, she's a housekeeper. Sure.
Well, is there anything that you haven't done? In fact, I'm going to ask you how old you are soon. For what you've crammed into your life, you should be about 97.
75, just turned.
But really, it's just glorious. You're still working. You're still a busy pharmacist.
And still a qualified pharmacist.
And still operating a post shop.
And that's getting more difficult.
So, thank you very much for the interview.
I can give you, if you want any family information, I've recorded it all there.
I think Jeff forgot to say that he got bees as well.
Oh, beekeeper.
You're a beekeeper?
Yeah.
How many hives?
Oh, I had 120 hives at one stage. Yeah, I'm down to two and the wasps picked up on this last season.
So, I've just been presented with some beautiful honey from another venture of Jeff's, beekeeping.
Yeah, when I was in Jumata Peak, I established 120 hives and exported honey to Singapore. So we're down to two hives and we just have to get two more hives established as the wasp got them this year.
There are now, I think, something like 2,000 beekeepers in New Zealand, and they're posing the greatest threat that the bee industry have ever had.
Wasps?
No, beekeepers, because they're not policing their hives.
No, they're not.
The mite doesn't get them.
Yep, they're not.